Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the August 18th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is How Much is Trump Profiting Off the Presidency? By David D. Kirkpatrick. A reporter at large, how much is Trump profiting off the presidency? An honest accounting of our executive-in-chief's runaway self-enrichment. By David D. Kirkpatrick. At a press conference on January 11, 2017, President-elect Donald Trump explained for the first time how he would handle the many conflicts of interest that his business empire posed for his new role. His company, the Trump Organization, collected money from all over the world for luxury condos, hotel rentals, development projects, and club memberships, and he had made deals that put his name on everything from mail-order steaks to get-rich-quick courses. Could citizens trust him to put the common good ahead of personal profit? How would he assure Americans that payments to his businesses weren't doubling as payoffs? A journalist asked Trump if he would release his tax returns, as presidents had done for decades. Trump said no, and then explained just how unconstrained he felt by such conventions. He'd recently learned that the president, being beholden only to the voters, is subject to none of the regulations that restrict subordinate officials from conducting private business on the side. He called the loophole a no-conflict of interest provision, as if it were a perk of his employment contract. To illustrate just how glaring a conflict the law allowed him, Trump volunteered that, during the transition, he'd entertained a $2 billion offer to do a deal in Dubai. The offer had come from Hussein Sajwani, an Emirati real estate tycoon with close ties to his country's rulers. Trump emphasized that he didn't have to turn it down. Nevertheless, he'd passed because he didn't want to take advantage of something. He disliked the way that looks. Therefore, he continued his eldest sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, would assume daily management of his businesses until he left office. Trump then turned things over to Sherry Dillon, one of his tax lawyers, who argued that he could hardly be expected to do more than the temporary handover. Trump would not destroy the company he built. Since Trump's star turn on the NBC reality show The Apprentice, the Trump Organization had mainly sold the use of his name. Most of its profits came from developers who flew the Trump flag over buildings that he didn't build or own, or from businesses that used his name to sell shirts, mattresses, or pizza. If Trump tried to offload his whole company, Dillon explained, a buyer might overpay in order to curry favor with the president, or just as worrisome, might demean the highest office in the land by crassly cashing in on the president's name. Trump and his family, Dillon declared, would never do anything that might be perceived to be exploitive of the office of the presidency. That was a different era. Dillon's firm stopped representing Trump in 2021 after the mob he stirred up attacked the U.S. Capitol. And in Trump's second term, the president and his family have paid no mind to their lawyer's promise. During Trump's first term, they pledged to abstain from any new deals overseas. That's out the window. The Trumps are now cashing in on five major deals in the Persian Gulf alone. Donald Jr., on a recent visit to Qatar, said that the family's restraint during the first Trump administration had not stopped his father's critics from constantly accusing the family of profiteering. So the Trumps would no longer lock themselves in a proverbial padded room because it almost doesn't matter. They're going to hit you no matter what. A spokeswoman for the Trump Organization told me that it employs an outside ethics advisor, currently Karina Lynch, a lawyer and a lobbyist who previously worked as a Republican Senate staffer and who has represented Donald Jr. to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Many payments now flowing to Trump, his wife, and his children and their spouses would be unimaginable without his presidencies. A $2 billion investment from a fund controlled by the Saudi crown prince, a luxury jet from the Emir of Qatar, profits from at least 5 different ventures peddling crypto, fees from an exclusive club stocked with cabinet officials and named executive branch. Fred Wertheimer, the Dean of Ethics Reform Advocates, told me that when it comes to using his public office to amass personal profits, Trump is a unicorn. No one even comes close. Yet the public has largely shrugged. In a recent article for The Times, Peter Baker, a White House correspondent, wrote that the Trumps have done more to monetize the presidency than anyone who has ever occupied the White House. But Baker noted that the brazenness of the Trumps' family money-making schemes appears to have made such transactions seem almost normal. How much money does it all amount to? What's the number? In March, Forbes, known for ranking the wealth of billionaires, estimated that Trump's net worth had more than doubled in the previous year, surpassing $5 billion. In July, The Times put Trump's wealth at upward of $10 billion. Yet both estimates included billions of dollars in paper profits that would almost certainly disintegrate if the Trumps pulled out of certain investments. What's Truth Social worth without him? These estimates also included assets untainted by any obvious exploitation of the presidency, such as properties that Trump owned before entering office, or fees paid by resort customers who simply want to play golf or book a hotel room. Although the notion that Trump is making colossal sums off the presidency has become commonplace, nobody could tell me how much he's made. Norm Eisen, a government ethics lawyer and a vocal Trump critic, said, "We don't know the full amounts." Robert Weissman, a co-president of the left-leaning advocacy group Public Citizen, said, "We will never really know." Wertheimer noted that for decades, Trump had boasted constantly and in detail about how rich he was. "He doesn't talk about it anymore," Wertheimer said. "He may be the greatest con artist in American history." A more considered accounting seemed in order. I decided to attempt to tally up just how much Trump and his immediate family have pocketed off his time in the White House. In financial terms, the presidency came to Trump at a fortuitous moment. Russ Butner and Suzanne Craig, The Times reporters who obtained some of Trump's tax returns, conclude in their book, Lucky Loser, that by 2015 he had burned through much of the vast fortune passed on to him by his self-made father, an inheritance worth as much as $500 million today. If Trump had put that money into the stock market, he could have ended up much richer. His lifestyle also guzzled money. In 1990, in a deal to keep the Trump Organization out of bankruptcy, his lenders agreed that he needed $450,000 a month just to make ends meet. The Apprentice, on which he played the outsized version of himself that he has always tried to project to the world, once covered his losses. In the 7 years following its debut in 2004, the show paid him $135.2 million. And its glamorizing effect allowed him to make money without buying or building anything, just by licensing his name and selling endorsements. Nearly all the real estate projects he announced during this period, from Hawaii to Israel, were licensing deals. Licensing and endorsements made him $103.2 million in riskless profit. "I don't want to say it was free revenue," Donald Jr. later testified in a New York court, but he did allow that the company's licensing business was a pretty spectacular system. Yet even the Apprentice windfall wasn't enough to keep Trump in the black. According to annual reports that the Trumps sent their lenders from 2011 to 2017, during those years, Trump brought in $259 million from television and licensing contracts, but thanks to his habit of overspending on properties, he still reported a negative cash flow of $46.8 million. Dwindling viewership numbers had killed The Apprentice in 2010, and by 2015, its doubly gimmicky offspring, The Celebrity Apprentice, was ailing too. Trump's licensing, endorsement, and apprentice income fell to $22 million that year. Butner and Craig note that between 2014 and 2016, Trump sold about $220 million in stock, nearly all his stock holdings, apparently to make up for losses, as that income tapered off. Then, on June 16, 2015, Trump launched his first presidential campaign with a speech in which he described Mexican immigrants as criminals and rapists. NBC kicked him off the air. Macy's, Serta, and Phillips Van Heusen ended endorsement deals. After Trump won the election, lawsuits filed in the backlash against his presidency added some big new expenses. By the start of his second term, he owed nearly $500 million to New York State, which had sued him for fraud, and more than $88 million to E. Jean Carroll, who had sued him for sexual assault and defamation. Appeals are still pending. Trump, in short, was in a tight spot when he first entered the White House, and in an even tighter spot when he returned. Just 6 months later, his financial situation has vastly improved. Trump's critics often describe his administration as an oligarchy or kleptocracy, conjuring parallels with Vladimir Putin. Yet experts who track international corruption told me that this is going too far. Global titans of self-dealing, such as Najib Razak, Malaysia's former prime minister, divert vast sums from national coffers directly into their bank accounts. U.S. prosecutors have charged that Razak stole about $4.5 billion, including by transferring about $700 million into his personal accounts. Nobody has credibly accused Trump of simply embezzling payments to the IRS. Gary Kalman, the executive director at the U.S. branch of the corruption watchdog Transparency International, cautioned against making stuff up just because everything is believable. Critics of Trump's oligarchy invariably point to his relationship with Elon Musk. Musk contributed more than $290 million to back Trump and other Republicans in 2024. Trump then gave him an administration role with seemingly extra legal powers to reorder federal agencies. All the while, Musk's businesses, Tesla, SpaceX, and Starlink, were profiting from government contracts or subsidies. In March, the president performed in what was effectively a television commercial on the White House lawn. Trump, after announcing that he would purchase a red Tesla parked there, declared, "It's a great product, as good as it gets." All that may be unseemly, yet every American political campaign relies on private donations. All modern presidents have solid access for campaign money, and all have rewarded donors with political appointments, especially ambassadorships. More important, campaign finance laws restrict how Trump can use his political war chest. Since re-entering the White House, Trump has raised the record-breaking sum of $600 million for his political operation. He can tap into that reserve to attack congressional enemies, and he can direct it toward other campaigns. Donald Jr. has contemplated a presidential run. Yet the money generally can't bankroll personal expenses. In the campaign money game, Trump plays at an Olympian level, but he hasn't changed the rules. Personal self-enrichment is where Trump is a true innovator, and his winnings in that category are also harder to quantify. On his tax returns, Trump has aggressively minimized the value of his assets and maximized the extent of his losses. On loan applications, he's done the opposite, puffing up his wealth to borrow as much as possible. And on the financial disclosure forms he's been required to fill out as a candidate or as president, he usually provides only a business's gross revenue, not its bottom line, thus reporting tens of millions of dollars in income from hotels that are actually losing money. Bruce Dubinsky, a forensic accountant who testified in the fraud trial of Bernie Madoff and investigated the collapse of Lehman Brothers as a part of its bankruptcy, closely followed Trump's New York fraud trial. Dubinsky told me that the opaque ownership structure of the Trump businesses makes it difficult to assess changes in his net worth. It's similarly hard to isolate his presidential profits, in part because estimating how much his businesses might have made if he weren't president would require detailed comparisons with similar enterprises that have non-presidential owners. By way of example, Dubinsky, who lives in Florida, noted that he'd recently visited the Trump Golf Center in Jupiter just to play golf. He added, so how much value to assign to his status as president is a daunting task. That blurriness is why ethics experts say that any outside business can pose a conflict of interest and may open a conduit for bribery. But propriety aside, I was, after a fair, dispassionate quantification of the Trump's profits from two presidencies. Mar-a-Lago, the for-profit club that has become the MAGA Mecca and the weekend White House, was an obvious place to start. In 2016, Trump, while running for president, was also suing a restaurateur for cutting ties over his bigoted comments about Mexican immigrants. In a deposition that summer, Trump testified that the presidential race had so far had no huge impact on his hotel and resort businesses, which were fairly steady. One exception, he said, was Mar-a-Lago, the Palm Beach estate he turned into a private club after acquiring it in 1985 for roughly $10 million. As though surprised by a happy accident, Trump testified that, according to the club's manager, the campaign had given Mar-a-Lago the best year we've ever had. If many presidents have traded access for campaign donations, only Trump has run a business selling an open-ended opportunity to mingle with him and his circle. In addition to the revenue he generated by holding his own campaign events at his club, he has profited from other candidates, conservative groups, and influence seekers rushing to hold events there too. The club says that it limits membership to 500 people. Each reportedly pays an annual fee of about $20,000. But after the 2016 election, Trump began jacking up the initiation fee. In 2016, it was $100,000. Last year, it was set to rise to $1 million. Trump's financial disclosure forms indicate that since 2014, Mar-a-Lago's annual revenue has jumped from $10 million to $50 million. At the same time, Forbes reported operating costs have been stable, ranging from $12 million to $16 million a year. Adding it all up, I calculated that Trump's presidencies have brought him at least $125 million in extra profits from Mar-a-Lago. Estimated gain, $125 million. Legal fees and Trump merch. Although candidates cannot pocket campaign contributions, no president has ever tried as hard as Trump to siphon off at least some of that money. According to the nonprofit Open Secrets, in the past decade, Trump's campaigns have spent more than $20 million at his own hotels and resorts, contributing to Mar-a-Lago's spike in profits. But how much, if any, of this money reached his personal accounts is impossible to guess. Trump's 2016 and 2024 campaign operations paid him a total of $18 million for the use of his own Boeing 757, the so-called Trump Force One. Air Force One ferried him around during the 2020 campaign, as is standard for a sitting president. But Barack Obama in 2008 and Mitt Romney in 2012 each spent a comparable sum to charter campaign planes. Trump, however, is the first presidential candidate to run a private online store that competes against his own campaign in selling campaign-style merch, effectively diverting his supporters' money into his own pocket. It's as if a fashion designer had set up a table in front of a department store to sell knockoffs of his own company's products at the expense of its shareholders. Among the Trump store's wares, a red Gulf of America baseball hat, $50, a pair of Trump beer koozies, $18, and Trump flip-flops, $40. Buyers might well believe that such purchases funded the MAGA cause or its candidates, yet Trump's financial disclosure forms indicate that he has made more than $17 million in income from such sales. At those prices, with negligible marketing expenses, thanks to his role as head of state, that income is surely almost all profit. Trump's most recent disclosure form also listing licensing income of $1.1 million from a Trump guitar, $2.8 million from Trump watches, $2.5 million from sneakers and fragrances, $3 million from an illustrated book called Save America, and $1.3 million from a God Bless the USA Bible, that adds up to at least $27.7 million from faux campaign paraphernalia. A political campaign fund cannot pay a candidate's personal legal bills. But Trump found a loophole. A campaign fund can be converted into a political action committee, and the looser restrictions on a PAC allow the use of donor funds to pay such expenses. Through his PACs, Trump has spent more than $100 million of his supporters' contributions to defend himself against an array of charges, that he defamed E. Jean Carroll while denying her account of his sexual assault, that he fraudulently hid a payoff to a porn star during the 2016 campaign, that he conspired to overturn the results of the 2020 election, and that he stole and hid classified documents after leaving the White House. Unless all of those charges are part of a vast deep state conspiracy, relieving Trump of the bills looks like a $100 million gift for personal expenses. Estimated gain, $127.7 million. Running total, $252.7 million. The D.C. Hotel. During the president's first term, no business figured more prominently in Democratic allegations of corruption than did the Trump International Hotel in Washington. Zach Everson, who wrote an online newsletter about the scene there, told me that the hotel was the epicenter of the swamp. Foreign leaders booked blocks of rooms, industry trade groups held conventions, lobbyists, lawmakers, and cabinet officials crowded the bar. Trump often visited. Staff told Everson that tips suffered because guests stayed at their tables to gawk until the president left. If you wanted to curry his favor, where else in Washington where would you stay? In 2018, when T-Mobile was seeking regulatory approval to acquire Sprint, John Laguerre, then T-Mobile's chief executive, was spotted there. In 10 months, he and other company executives spent nearly $200,000 at the hotel. Laguerre denied any scheme to influence the White House and said he was a longtime Trump hotel stayer. The merger was approved. All this patronage surely flattered Trump's ego, but it never fattened his wallet. The hotel lost money each year of his first term, a total of more than $70 million. Industry executives familiar with the hotel's operations told me that Trump's presidency repelled as many potential customers as it attracted. Many foreign leaders, lobbyists, and executives who might have otherwise have paid handsomely for the Trump Hotel's location and luxury stayed elsewhere, fearing entanglement in an influence scandal. T-Mobile's Laguerre endured a grilling on Capitol Hill about his choice of accommodations. In the 2 years after Trump's election, hotels in Toronto, New York, Rio de Janeiro, and Panama City that had licensed the Trump name ditched it, presumably in part because it was driving away business. A Hawaii hotel followed suit in 2023. Trump had agreed in 2012 to pay the federal government at least $3 million a year for a long-term lease of the D.C. building, a former post office headquarters, and to invest at least $200 million in renovations. The hotel opened in 2016, and Trump sold it in 2022 for $375 million. Craig and Butner, after reviewing his tax returns, concluded that he roughly broke even. Hilton Hotels took over the management under its Waldorf Astoria brand, and people familiar with its operations said that its financial performance has improved markedly. During Trump's first term, Trump Turnberry, his golf course resort in Scotland, also drew allegations of improper presidential self-enrichment because the U.S. military sometimes paid to put up service members there during overnight stops at the nearby Prestwick Airport. During the 23 months ending in July 2019, the Pentagon spent at least $184,000 at Trump Turnberry at a discounted nightly room rate of averaging $189.04. Yet that property, too, lost money all 4 years of the first Trump administration. It finally entered the black in 2022, and U.S. service members continue to stay there under President Joe Biden. An Air Force spokesman told me that there had been no change in the military's use of the facility. Air crews are allowed to select the Trump Turnberry Resort, along with other hotel options in the area, if the lodging meets specific criteria of availability, suitability, expense, and proximity. Spending at Trump's hotels by government agencies and influence seekers looked to me like a wash. Estimated gain, zero. Running total, $252.7 million. The Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf has posed a unique commercial opportunity and ethical challenge for the first commander-in-chief, who's also a real estate salesman. The Gulf's Arab monarchs play complementary double roles. Each is both head of state and a major buyer of U.S. real estate and others' assets. The Gulf royals put money in the very kind of properties and investments that Trump's family sells. In a recent interview with Tucker Carlson, Steve Witkoff, Trump's Middle East envoy and a fellow real estate mogul, expressed delight that the mindset of Gulf rulers facilitates dealmaking. Everybody's a business guy there. But these business guys were deeply entangled with the Trump crowd. Trump, Witkoff, and others in the two Trump administrations, including Jared Kushner, the husband of Trump's daughter Ivanka, had sold or tried to sell assets to the Gulf's ruling families before entering government. And both sides can expect to do business again once Trump leaves office. Unlike heads of state in, say, Western Europe, the Gulf monarchs wield extraordinary power over the businesses of their subjects. A Gulf monarch controls the fossil fuel revenue that ultimately drives every enterprise in his country, from the lowliest shawarma stand to the finest resort, and he is unconstrained by independent courts or Western-style laws that might protect private interests. The richer a Gulf tycoon, the more he must depend on his sovereign's goodwill. So a deal with a private firm is sometimes not much different from a deal with a ruler. During the 2016 Republican primaries, Trump boasted of having sold condos to Saudis. "They buy apartments from me. They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much." Nevertheless, he'd struggled to make licensing deals in the Gulf. The few developers outside North America willing to pay for the use of his family name were mostly building condominiums in lower rent parts of the developing world. He'd made hundreds of thousands of dollars a year licensing his name for a two-tower project in Istanbul. On his three most recent annual disclosure forms, he reported receiving $489,182, $392,360, and $288,061. Reporting periods can be irregular. He had also licensed his name for four apartment towers in India, six in South Korea, one in the Philippines, and another in Uruguay. Resorts or other planned ventures in Georgia, Azerbaijan, and elsewhere fell through after he was elected. Trump's only beachhead was in the Gulf, was a deal with Hussein Sejwani, the tycoon close to Emirati rulers. In 2013, Sejwani, the self-styled Donald of Dubai, had agreed to pay the Trump Organization to manage a Trump-branded golf course surrounded by villas in Dubai. When Trump was running for president in 2016, at least one emissary for the campaign suggested to the Emirati rulers that Trump's deal with Sejwani gave them an in. Tom Barak, Trump's friend and informal advisor, wrote in an email to the Emirati ambassador Yosef Al-Attabai that Trump has joint ventures in the UAE. Barak prompted the UAE to begin courting Kushner, Trump's incoming Middle East advisor, and his effort appeared to pay off stunningly. Through Kushner, the Emiratis helped persuade Trump to travel to the Persian Gulf for his first presidential trip abroad. They also helped get Trump to support their preferred heir to the Saudi throne, Mohammed bin Salman, now the crown prince and de facto ruler, instead of a royal cousin who'd long been the American favorite. Most remarkably, in 2017, Trump supported the UAE and Saudi Arabia in a feud with neighboring Qatar. The Emiratis and the Saudis had accused their regional rival of supporting Islamist movements and organized a blockade designed to starve the country. Qatar is a Pentagon partner, largely funding an American airbase west of Doha, and Trump's stance contradicted the positions of his secretaries of state and defense. The Saudis and the Emiratis patched things up with Qatar at the end of Trump's first term. He and the rulers involved now act like the blockade never happened. Had the payments for the Dubai golf course helped the Emiratis win Trump's favor? You're listening to the New Yorker Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Would a deal with the Trump Organization have protected Qatar? A senior official of a Gulf state told me that the region's rulers now view business with Trump as a kind of a safeguard. It did not take long after Trump's first term for his family to return to the Gulf. He had left the White House in disgrace following the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol, but the scandal didn't dislodge him from his position as a political kingmaker. Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, had to make a pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago to atone for declaring that Trump must accept responsibility for instigating the riot. Yet Trump and his family were now liberated from duties of public office and freer than ever to cash in on his status as the once-and-future president. Kushner went first. During Trump's first term, he'd quietly backed Mohammed bin Salman during the prince's consolidation of power in Riyadh, even pushing Trump to stand by him after Saudi agents murdered Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist and a Virginia resident. Shortly after leaving the White House, Kushner asked the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund to invest $2 billion with the private equity firm that he was founding, Affinity Partners. The Saudi fund's panel of investment advisors unanimously objected. Kushner had worked almost exclusively in real estate and never in private equity, and he was asking the Saudis to put up a vast sum when no American had invested a penny. The panel clawed the management fee that Kushner wanted, 1.25% of the firm's assets or $25 million each year, excessive, given his lack of relevant experience. The advisors also worried about a public relations problem. The deal might look like a payoff. The Saudi funds board, controlled by the Crown Prince, ignored the advice. $2 billion it was. Emirati and Qatari investors soon kicked in hundreds of millions more. Terry Gao, the Taiwanese businessman and politician who founded the manufacturing giant Foxconn and maintains close ties to China's leaders, also invested. While in the White House, Kushner helped arrange subsidies for a Foxconn factory in Wisconsin. And in 2024, as Trump was poised to retake the presidency, Kushner's firm raised an additional $1.5 billion from the Qataris and Emiratis, bringing its assets under management to $4.8 billion. If all the investors besides the Saudis pay the industry standard management fee of 2% a year, Affinity's annual revenue comes to $81 million. Under conventional private equity terms, Kushner's firm, after repaying management fees, can keep an additional 20% of any returns on its investments, although Kushner agreed to share some of that with the Saudis. That cut of the profits is typically the biggest windfall for a private equity firm, and reports indicate that at least some of Kushner's early investments, including in an Israeli financial firm and a German fitness company, are paying off. But even if Kushner fails utterly, a renewable energy lender that his fund invested in, Solar Mosaic, recently filed for bankruptcy, in part because of Trump policy changes, Affinity still stands to take in $810 million over 10 years, a typical lifespan for such a fund. Congressional Democrats have asked if Kushner might be selling influence as part of the deal. Since leaving the Trump administration, Kushner has described himself as an informal foreign policy advisor to his father-in-law and to members of Congress. He's also reportedly conversed with the Saudi Crown Prince about such foreign policy matters as relations with Israel, and at a conference last year, he said that, thanks to his White House experience, he and his firm could do things on the geopolitical side and on the connections side. Last fall, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon and Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland unsuccessfully urged the Biden administration's Department of Justice to appoint a special counsel to investigate whether Kushner was illegally acting as an unregistered foreign agent. In a public letter, Wyden and Raskin argued that the Saudi government's decision to engage Affinity for investment advice appeared to be a fig leaf for funneling money directly to Mr. Kushner and his wife Ivanka Trump, possibly to curry favor or reward them for favorable U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia during the first Kushner administration. Kushner called the letter a political stunt and has argued that critical coverage of the Saudi deal only helps his firm. Although journalists think they're writing a bad thing, he told Forbes, business people who read those articles discover that I'm very trusted by my partners. Affinity's fees, of course, must cover overhead from staff compensation to office space. But Kushner is the founder and sole owner, and it's unimaginable that the firm could have reaped such sums from those investors without his father-in-law's presidencies. We might conservatively assume that he personally keeps between half and two-thirds of Affinity's fees over 10 years. He will make far more if the fund turns a profit. Half would be $405 million. On Wall Street, the present value of that stream of future income, taking into account the cost of delay, is about $320 million. Kushner also has real estate projects in the works that pose additional conflicts of interest for Trump. A partnership with the Serbian government, backed by an Emirati investor, to build a Trump-branded hotel in Belgrade has been derailed by the discovery that its approval was based on a document that a Serbian official allegedly forged. But in January, the Albanian government preliminarily approved a partnership with Kushner to build a 111-acre resort in one of the few undeveloped islands in the Mediterranean. The project is said to entail a $100.4 billion investment. Still, both are real estate developments Kushner's area of expertise. Unlike with the Saudi investment, it's unfair to attribute those deals entirely to Trump's public office, and it's premature to guess what Kushner or his investors in the projects might someday earn. It is safest to say only that his private equity firm has added at least $320 million to the family's presidential profits. Estimated gain, $320 million. Running total, $572.7 million. More Saudi deals. Trump's first business with the Saudis upon leaving the White House involved golf. After the Capitol riot, the PGA of America canceled the contract to hold its televised championship the next year at his course in Bedminster, New Jersey, depriving Trump of valuable publicity. Fortunately for him, Saudi Arabia was launching its own pro golf association, LIV, and it agreed to hold a televised tournament at Bedminster. The next year, LIV announced a framework agreement to merge with the PGA Tour. The deal hasn't yet closed. But holding the LIV tournament at Bedminster may have made sense for both parties, even if Trump had never been president. Trump has said that he only got peanuts from LIV, and that's normal. Clubs host such events mainly for publicity. The Saudis, for their part, secured access to a nice golf course at a time when many wouldn't welcome them, given their human rights records and LIV's rivalry with the PGA Tour. This alliance of pariahs may have drawn Trump and the Saudis closer together, but it's hard to say that he benefited more than they did, and not much money changed hands. The Trump Organization has recently signed or completed some deals to license the president's name for real estate projects that extended the company's apprentice-era business model. Before the president took office in 2017, a businessman and politician in Indonesia had licensed the Trump name for two golf projects. One opened in 2025, the other is still in the works. A longtime Trump Organization partner in India is adding six Trump residential projects to the four that predated Trump's election. Indians evidently wanted to live in Trump Towers even when he was just a fading reality television star. A recent rush of Saudi investments in Trump-branded real estate in the Gulf, however, would be hard to fathom without the Trump presidencies. By 2020, with Trump's image tarnished by his tumultuous political career, many developers saw less economic value in his name than they once had. The number of international developers paying to license his name had fallen to 5, down from 11 before he ran for president. But in November 2022, Trump, after becoming the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, announced an anomalous new deal. Dar al-Arkan, a Saudi real estate company, had agreed to pay the Trump Organization to manage both a Trump hotel and a Trump golf course at a vast cliffside development in Muscat, Oman. In addition, Trump would likely get a cut from sales of villas surrounding the course. The Sultan of Oman is also a partner. The project, when completed, will be the Trump Organization's first hotel management deal overseas. Small-scale managers like the Trump Organization, which currently runs just 8 hotels, can typically land only 10-year contracts, but the Oman project reportedly made a 3-decade commitment. Developers tend to grant such terms to behemoths like Hilton or Marriott, whose scale enables them to lower costs and attract customers in ways that the Trumps never could. In the months after Trump's re-election, Donald Jr. and Eric signed a blitz of licensing deals with the same Saudi company for major projects in Riyadh, Jeddah, Dubai, and Doha. Given that the family has acknowledged trying for decades to plant the Trump flag in the Gulf, these mega deals are inconceivable without Trump's presidency. How much are they all paying? After the pandemic, the financial performance of the Dubai golf course stabilized. Trump reported on his last 3 annual disclosure forms that managing the course paid him $1,283,889, $1,109,950, and $1,078,996. He now stands to make at least $1 million a year as long as Sejuani renews the management contract, and Sejuani would be foolish to cancel while Trump is president. I estimated that Trump, by the end of his second term, will have made more than $9 million from managing that course. Golf industry experts say that, in effect, the Trump Organization merely oversees the local operations of the club and probably keeps more than 80% of those fees as profit. That would net Trump about $7.2 million. In addition, the licensing fees from the Dubai golf course, which Trump reported on his last 3 disclosure forms, totaled $9.7 million. Much of this money likely comes from his cut of sales of condos around the course. Such fees are usually almost all profit. Trump's new golf deals are even more lucrative. Although the Oman project isn't scheduled to open until 2028, Trump has reported on his 3 most recent annual disclosure forms a total of $8.8 million in licensing income from it. This presumably includes a cut of villa pre-sales. He will also manage new golf courses in Muscat, Riyadh, and Doha. Extrapolating from the one in Dubai, these 3 could bring in more than $24 million in profit in their first 10 million in their first 10 years. Present value $19 million. Moreover, Trump's name will hang on 4 other new condo or villa projects in Riyadh, Jeddah, Dubai, and Doha. Taking the average of his licensing fees from similar projects in Dubai and Muscat, we might estimate that each one brings in $9 million in profits in the first 3 years of sales, for a total of $36 million. He recently reported $5 million in licensing fees just a few months after announcing the Dar al-Arkan project in Dubai, suggesting even higher profits. Another prize will be the management and licensing fees from planned hotels at the projects in Dubai and Muscat. Because the Trumps never had managed an overseas hotel before, I looked at the income from a Trump-branded hotel in Honolulu. Before its owners took down his name, it typically brought him about $2 million a year in licensing and management fees, according to his financial disclosure forms. Assuming 30-year deals at both Gulf hotels and extrapolating from the Hawaiian model, managing the 2 hotels for the full term might bring him in $120 million in fees. To break out Trump's bottom line, I spoke to Dan Wasoliak, a hospitality analyst at Morningstar, an investment research firm. He has been willing to speak publicly about the Trump Organization's finances. Many prefer to avoid the president's wrath. Wasoliak told me that a typical profit margin on hotel management fees is about 65%. That would net Trump $78 million, present value $42 million, but it'll probably make much more because some of that is all profit licensing income. In all, the Gulf projects that the Trump Organization has signed since 2022 are worth at least $105.8 million. Estimated gain, $105.8 million. Running total, $678.5 million. The private jet. In May, the president returned from formal state visits to Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar with his most unusual deal so far, one without any pretense of a sale. He announced that the Emir of Qatar had agreed to make a free gift of a Royal Boeing 747-8 for Trump's use as a flashy presidential jet. Trump characterized the transfer as a boon for American taxpayers. The Air Force would retain ownership of the plane until he left office. Yet Trump also said that the Pentagon would then pass the jet to his Presidential Library Foundation. This free gift looked enough like a personal favor that the Emir has requested a memorandum of understanding confirming that it's a donation from one government to another in order to protect him from allegations of bribery. He also wants it in writing that Qatar didn't propose the handover and made it only at the president's request. A Qatari official told me that negotiations are ongoing. In the end, Trump may never get to enjoy it. Upgrading the plane to meet presidential security requirements could cost more than $1 billion, which would normally require appropriation by Congress, and the work might not be finished before Trump leaves office. Still, on May 21st, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth announced that he'd accepted the jet. The Qataris bought the plane from Boeing 13 years ago. Its list price was $367 million. The Times reported that it might sell on the used jet market for $150 million. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, told me in an email that any gift given by a foreign government is always accepted in full compliance with all applicable laws. But it's reasonable to suggest that the jet would have been offered to any president but Trump. Perhaps the Gulf rulers see such transactions as a form of insurance, a way to avoid the kind of hardship that befell Qatar during Trump's first administration. The payments may also have brought goodwill. Trump, standing near Mohammed bin Salman on a recent trip to Saudi Arabia, unexpectedly announced that he would end sanctions against Syria, currently led by a former al-Qaeda fighter who was trying to prove that he was reformed. "Oh, what I do for the Crown Prince," Trump reflected aloud. During his first term, Trump had disappointed the Arab Gulf rulers by declining to retaliate against their regional nemesis, Iran, after an attack on a Saudi oil processing facility at Abqaiq. In June, when Trump ordered airstrikes on Iran, the Arab monarchs surely cheered. Estimated gain, $150 million. Running total, $828.5 million. Trump Hotel Hanoi. In September 2024, with polls forecasting Trump's likely return to office, Thom Lan, the General Secretary of Vietnam's ruling Communist Party, visited New York and dispatched a Central Committee member to wrap up Trump's resort deal. The Central Committee member oversaw the signing of an agreement between the Party Committee of Hunan Province and a consortium of investors arranged by the Trump Organization. The same day, Trump took time away from the campaign to join Eric in signing an agreement with a Vietnamese company, known for its office parks, that would build the property and pay the Trumps for the use of their name. The planned development, with a projected cost of $1.5 billion, will include a hotel, residences, and 54 holes of golf, occupying an area three times the size of Central Park. It appears to be the largest Trump-branded development in the world. Trump's past levies on imports from China spurred businesses to shift operations to Vietnam, and exports to the U.S. now account for about a third of Vietnam's economy. Trump's protectionist tariffs therefore pose both a threat and an opportunity to Vietnam, giving it singular incentive to cultivate his goodwill. Perhaps with that in mind, Vietnamese authorities have expedited the resort project, overriding local laws and procedures. In a letter obtained by the Times, Vietnamese officials said that they were accelerating the project because it is receiving special attention from the Trump administration and President Donald Trump personally. Would this deal have happened in this form if Trump had retired to Mar-a-Lago in 2021? Unlikely. On his most recent financial disclosure form, Trump reported $5 million in initial income from licensing his name to the project, which is expected to open in 2027. The development's huge scale and the unique character of the Vietnamese market make projecting profits difficult. Even if the deal extends for just 10 years and the Trump organization makes only as much each year as it did in the first few months, that will be $50 million. Present value, $40 million. Judging from other Trump licensing deals, the actual profits will likely be higher. In July, Trump said that he had reached a provisional trade agreement with Vietnam. He had been threatening a 46% tariff, but he said that the new deal lowered that to 20%. The Vietnamese, contradicting him, have insisted that they are negotiating for an even lower rate. Estimated gain, $40 million, running total, $868.5 million. The corporate squeeze. In a 2016 Law Review article, Susan Seeger, a First Amendment lawyer and a professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, described Trump as a libel loser. In the past 5 decades, he has lost or withdrawn a dozen suits against media companies and failed to follow through on many other threats. The handful of claims that he filed after leaving the White House all seem certain to end similarly. Last spring, for example, he sued ABC News for defamation because its anchor, George Stephanopoulos, said that a court had found Trump liable for rape. The court had found Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming E. Jean Carroll, and the judge had emphasized that Carroll had not failed to prove that Mr. Trump raped her, as many people commonly understood the word. To win his lawsuit, Trump would have to prove that Stephanopoulos spoke with actual malice, a seemingly insurmountable burden. But after the election, ABC News, a unit of Disney, abruptly settled the case. Confronting a plaintiff who now held enormous sway over its future regulation, Disney agreed to pay $15 million to Trump's Presidential Library Foundation, the same nonprofit that will presumably take ownership of the Qatari jet. Trump also sued Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram. After January 6, 2021, Meta, having concluded that he'd used its platforms to incite violence, suspended his accounts. His suit's tenuous claims was that Meta had somehow violated his First Amendment rights by yielding to pressure from Democratic officials. Yet a month after ABC's payment, Meta settled too, paying $22 million to Trump's library. Then X, formerly known as Twitter and now owned by Elon Musk, reportedly paid about $10 million to settle a similar suit. X has not said whether the company is paying the nonprofit or Trump himself. In July, CBS News, a unit of Paramount, agreed to pay the nonprofit $16 million to settle a lawsuit over which snippets of an interview with Kamala Harris it had chosen to broadcast. Media law experts considered all of Trump's recent claims ridiculous. Trump appears to be the first sitting president or presidential nominee in American history to sue for libel or defamation. Such contests could never be fair. A sitting president holds too much power over any defendant. None of these companies would have settled if Trump weren't president and wielding power over mergers and regulations and government contracts, Seeger said. Yet most of the settlements, like the Qatari jet, were paid to Trump's foundation. Should they count as personal profits? 25 years ago, President Bill Clinton endured an epic scandal related to a much smaller contribution to a similar nonprofit. Denise Rich, a Democratic donor, gave $450,000 to his Presidential Library Foundation, and Clinton, on his final day in office, pardoned her ex-husband, Mark Rich, a tax dodger and a sanctions evader who'd fled to Switzerland. Presidents George W. Bush, Obama, and Biden followed stricter procedures to avoid any appearance of selling a pardon, even for campaign donations. Trump has had no such qualms. The Times reported that he pardoned Paul Walsack, another wealthy tax evader, shortly after Walczak's mother paid $1 million to attend a Trump fundraiser. Walczak's pardon application reportedly cited his mother's contribution to Trump and to other Republicans. The Walczak payments, though, were political funds which politicians cannot use as personal piggy banks. Presidential library foundations have far fewer restrictions. The board of the Trump Library Foundation consists of one of his lawyers, one of his sons, and one of his son-in-laws. The foundation needs only to adhere to the purpose stated in the Articles of Incorporation, to preserve and steward the legacy of President Donald J. Trump. Harvard P. Dale, who heads the NYU School of Law's National Center on Philanthropy and the Law, told me that Trump's foundation couldn't simply transfer its money to Trump or his sons, but it could feasibly pay for Trump to travel the world. It might even be able to pay him directly as an advisor. After all, who knows better how to steward his legacy? Trevor Potter, the president of the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center and a Republican former chair of the FEC, told me that Trump's foundation will constitute an additional account that the former president will control and can use to benefit his post-presidential lifestyle. That's why I counted the Qatari jet as a personal profit. The same applies to the settlement payments. With another media giant, Amazon, the Trumps worked more directly. In December, over dinner at Mar-a-Lago, Melania Trump pitched Jeff Bezos, Amazon's chairman, on a documentary that she hoped to produce about her return to the White House. The competition for the rights was flaccid. The Wall Street Journal reported that Disney had offered $14 million, Netflix and Apple had declined to bid, but Amazon agreed to pay $40 million. Of course, former presidents and their wives routinely earn gigantic advances for memoirs, yet first couples have customarily waited until they've left office to open those auctions, avoiding the appearance that they might be selling influence. Amazon's data center business and Bezos' Blue Origin space travel company both received billions of dollars in government contracts. Melania Trump's cut of Amazon's payment is reportedly about $28 million. Estimated gain, $91 million. Running total, $959.5 million. And that's all we have time for today. David D. Kirkpatrick, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is the author of Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.